In a 1978 New York Times Magazine article about Judy Blume, Joyce Maynard wrote, "The reason for her book's success probably goes beyond sexual explicitness. They may never become classics, but they are among the first juvenile books to abandon happy endings, the notion of perfect parents, and images of children whose most serious problems are getting a horse or a paper route. If the book seemed to dwell on sexuality, it's simply because they reflect kids' concerns, and sex is high on that list." Judy Blume also writes novels for adults. Her novel Wifey was about a suburban woman in an unhappy marriage who has a series of affairs. It was a bestseller. Her new novel, Smart Women, is about two 42-year-old divorced women who are casual acquaintances and their teenage daughters. One of the women becomes lovers with the other woman's ex-husband in spite of her better judgment. Her teenage daughter is always embarrassed by her mother's behavior when she's in love. Meanwhile, her mother is worried about her daughter, who's involved with her first sexual relationship with a man. The point of view in the novel shifts between the mothers and the daughters. Smart Women is published by Putnam. Judy Blume, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
What kind of balance do you like to keep between your writing for adults and younger people?
I don't really think about it. I do an adult book when it's there and it has to come out.
It seems that in your new book, Smart Women, you have both incorporated into it. It's really a book for adults, but the perspective shifts from the perspective of the mothers who are 42 to the perspective of their teenage daughters.
Yeah, it's wonderful, and it was wonderful to write it because I learned a lot. Not only was I putting myself in the shoes of these 40-year-old women, but also 17-year-old daughter and a 12-year-old daughter, and seeing it from everybody's point of view, I think I grew and learned.
I'd like to ask you to read a passage from Smart Women, which I think shows those shifting viewpoints from the mother's view and the teenager's view.
I would love to. This is about Margot, who is 40, has been divorced for 5 years, and successful architect, and her daughter Michelle, who's 17, and has just returned from spending the summer with her father. Now Margot walked down the hall to say goodnight to her children. Michelle was sitting up in bed reading Lady Chatterley's Lover. "How do you like it?" Margot asked. "I'm only reading it because I have to. It's on my summer reading list," Michelle said defensively. Margot laughed. "Not the book, this." She twirled around the room, showing off her new silk robe, keeping time to the music coming from Michelle's stereo. It sounded like Joan Armatrading, but Margot couldn't be sure. Michelle was very into female vocalists singing about the female experience. "God, Mother, what is that thing you're wearing?" "It's a robe. Claire gave it to me for my birthday. Isn't it gorgeous?" "It's a weird gift for one divorced woman to give to another. She could have given you a painting from her gallery. We have a lot of bare white walls." "Well, I think she wanted to make it a personal gift." "Yeah, well, it's personal, all right. So how do you like it?" "It's okay, I guess, if you're into silks and satins." "I meant the book." Michelle looked up at Margot, her mouth set defiantly, ready to do battle. "I told you, it's a signed reading." "I know that, but you can still either like it or not like it." Margot warned herself to stop. This conversation was going nowhere. Michelle closed the book and rested it on her lap. She gave Margot a hostile look. "It's an interesting book, in an old-fashioned way." In an old-fashioned way, Margot thought? That was hard to take. She remembered when she'd read Lady Chatterley. She had been in college and found the sex scenes so steamy, she'd locked herself in the hall bathroom and stood under the shower for an hour. D.H. Lawrence lived in the Southwest, in Taos. Did you know that? "Of course I know that, Mother. But this particular book is set in England." "Yes," Margot said, "I know." She approached the bed and tried to drop a kiss on Michelle's cheek, but Michelle squirmed away. "Please, Mother, don't be disgusting." "Good night," Margot said, trying to sound pleasant, trying not to let Michelle see that she was getting to her. "Good night," Michelle answered, opening her book again. "And, Mother, you really should do something about your breath. Have you tried Lavoris?" "I had chili for lunch," Margot said. "Well, you don't have to advertise." Margot sighed and left the room. She did not understand how or why Michelle had turned into this impossible creature. Margot would never voluntarily live with such an angry, critical person. Never. But when it was your own child, you had no choice. So she kept on trying, kept hoping for the best, kept waiting for the sweetness to come back. What a case her mother was, running around in that robe that looked as if it belonged on some ancient movie star, and expecting Michelle to admire it or something. God! Michelle did not understand what was wrong with her mother. But ever since last winter, she had been impossible. Whatever Michelle said, Margot took in the wrong way. So naturally, she wasn't going to tell Margot the truth about the robe. On the plane, flying home today, Michelle had hoped that this school year would be better. She had vowed to try. No more towels on the bathroom floor, no more unwashed dishes left in the sink, and no more sarcasm. She had hoped that Margot would like her better this year and treat her as a human being, recognizing the fact that she had feelings too. But after just a few hours together, they were right back to where they had left off before the summer. Michelle tried to pinpoint the exact time of the change, but she couldn't. It wasn't the end of one of her mother's love affairs, which was always an intense time around the house, with Margot weeping all over the place, then putting on this big phony smile for the sake of the children. Also, at the end of an affair, Margot tended to appreciate her kids more and to show them a lot of attention and affection. No, it wasn't the end of an affair. Besides, Michelle kept mental notes of who her mother was sleeping with so that she would be prepared in case of a disaster. But for the past school year, there hadn't been anyone special. No one bringing his kids over for Sunday supper. No hour-long phone calls in the middle of the night. No one appearing in the kitchen unexpectedly in the morning. As far as Michelle could tell, her mother had just been sleeping around, and not that often either, so it wasn't sex. And it wasn't money or work either. There was time, right after the divorce, when money and work were Margot's number one problems, but not anymore. Michelle rolled over in bed and felt the beginning of a lump in her throat. She was scared out of her mind that if she couldn't make peace with Margot, Margot would ship her to New York, to Freddie and his wife. Well, let Margot try it. If she did, Michelle would run away, and then Margot would be really sorry. She hated it when people told her she looked like her mother. People were always telling kids they looked just like this parent or that one. If Michelle could look like anyone she knew, it would not be her mother. It would be Bibi, this big-time realtor in Boulder. Because when Bibi walked into a room, people noticed. Michelle wished that people would notice her that way. A lot of the time, Michelle felt invisible.
Thanks for reading that, and we just heard a passage from Judy Blume's new novel, Smart Women. Well, can you in your own life see both perspectives as easily as you have as a novelist in the sections that we just read, where you captured first the point of view of the mother and then the point of view of her teenage daughter?
I can see them, but in real life, emotions get in the way.
Do your children, do you think, expect you to see their side of you as clearly as a mother as you do as a novelist?
No, I think that my kids really separate the novelist from the mother. They really know me. I mean, they, you know, that's a wonderful thing. I think we've been through tough times, but we've come out of it and we're on an upswing now.
Parents are always talking about the problems of having a sexually active teenager, but a lot of what your book is about is the problems teenagers have when they have a sexually active parent. What are some of those problems that you try to go into?
Yeah, I think it's really tough. Kids who grow up living with their biological or adopted parents, where mom and dad are the same people all the time, don't have to confront or choose not to confront their parents' sexuality. Maybe they know it's there, but they don't really deal with it. And when you are a kid with a single parent, you are forced to confront your parents' sexuality, whether you want to or not. And I think when you're a teenager and you're beginning to deal with your own sexuality, to also have to deal with your mother's or your father's is embarrassing, is difficult. I once asked a group of single parents if they had sleepover dates, and they told me the most incredible stories. One woman said, Oh, no, I would never bring anyone home. So what I do is I call and I say, I've got a flat tire and I may not make it home. Now, her kids know what's going on, you know, but when somebody moves into the house and you watch the affection between your mother or your father and this stranger, it makes for an interesting novel. It makes for some difficulties in life.
In the novel that you've written, the daughter is very embarrassed by the mother's behavior when she falls in love. She finds it silly as well as embarrassing. Do you think that that's frequently the case with teenagers?
Yes, because I think that kids see things very clearly, and they do see their parents very clearly. And maybe their parents do look foolish, but they're looking at them through the eyes of inexperience. They've never really been there themselves. So they're quick to judge, but their judgments are not always right.
I think that the way you draw the adult women, that they become kind of adolescent when they fall in love. Like, one of the women keeps a list of all the lovers she's ever had in the top drawer in her office, a drawer that locks. That's really very young.
I think all lovers, everyone who falls in love reverts in part to adolescence, and I don't care how old you are, you're swept away by it. It's wonderful. It's fabulous.
I guess a lot of adults now are in the position, too, of really having to ask all the ethical implications of falling in love with the person who they think they're falling in love with, because maybe it's the ex-husband or ex-wife of someone who you know well or not so well, and maybe it's someone you think that wouldn't fall, that wouldn't get along so well with your children. There's just so many maybes. It seems, I guess, to get more complicated when
it's very
when you're
complicated.
Older.
I mean, you know, can new love survive when you fall in love at 35 or 40 or however old you are, and you bring to that new love a long history and children? It's very, very different. And I must say that I don't think that one woman could fall in love with the ex-husband of a close friend. And it's important for me to say that Margot and Bibi, the two women that we're talking about in this book, are not close friends. They do know each other. But there's a big difference. When you have an intimate relationship with someone, I don't think it's possible to fall in love with that person's former spouse.
I think you remarried when your children were teenagers.
I had a brief and very painful second marriage, which I jumped into immediately. As soon as I left one long marriage of 16 years, I wanted to be married again somehow. I thought I wanted freedom, and I thought I wanted to be single, and suddenly I said, oh, I want life to be smooth again, and I want everything to be in order, and I know how to be married, and I don't know how not to be married, and so I will marry this first nice man that I met, and it was disastrous for all of us.
How did you handle it with your children?
Not well.
Were they unhappy to have a new person in the house?
I don't think they were unhappy about that so much as they were unhappy about my unhappiness, and they were unhappy because it was a very stormy relationship, and their father and I had a very peaceful marriage, and it took a long time to be able to admit that it was a terrible mistake, and very, very difficult to be able to admit that and get out of it and start again. And now I have a 4.5 year wonderful, stable, loving relationship with someone. And his daughter is my stepdaughter. And that's, I think, why I wrote the book and why I think merging families and bringing in new children is a very important subject for today.
Do you think that parents should ask their children's permission to have somebody else move in the house?
Oh.
Like if you want your lover to move in with you or if you want to get married. And, you know, if your children are old enough to, like, really have developed personalities and needs and minds of their own.
And suppose they say no. I mean, that's right. That's what Margot's daughter says to her. She says, you could have waited. You could have waited. I'm going to be gone in 2 years. And Margot says what I guess I would say. It's my life, too. And maybe I just can't wait anymore. I've got to get on with my life. I think, sure, you should talk about it. But, I mean, asking their permission, that's putting too much on them. Because suppose they say no, and then suppose you're miserable, right? They're going to feel guilty. You're going to blame them. So I don't think you can really ask their permission.
Margot says at one point, we always have our kids with the wrong person. Do you think a lot of people feel that way now?
Oh.
Do you think a lot of people got married too young of the generation that you and your characters
are? Oh, my
are?
Generation. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I got married when I was a junior in college. My son is a junior in college. He can't believe it. I had my daughter at the very age that she is now. She's about to be 23. And she looks at me and says, I can't believe it. You had a baby when you were my age. Yeah, I think we got married for all the wrong reasons, what's more. I'm not sure that many of us ever get married for the right reasons. A lot of it is luck. But surely my generation growing up in the 50s, we did what our parents expected of us. We were raised to get married and have babies without really thinking about it.
Do you think that you learn a lot when you're through a couple of marriages that you can, like, apply to the next relationship and not make the same mistakes?
I would like to think so, but statistics show that we often make the same mistakes, and we continue to make mistakes. And what I've learned is how important it is to allow ourselves to make mistakes and to say, hey, that was a mistake, and not keep blaming ourselves and not feeling guilty forever.
I noticed that at the end of Smart Women, without saying anything about the ending, that you wouldn't write a pat happy ending without assuming that no matter what the ending is, that things can change. things get much better or much worse any minute.
One never knows. Yeah, I think my mother used to say, you can say that, but knock wood.
Right.
And Margot's mother says the same thing to her. But I have learned not to worry so much. I used to think if things were going really well in my life that there was going to be some suffering for it. And I don't know whether that was upbringing or experience because my father died a few weeks before I was to be married. And my husband's father died after our baby was born. And so it seemed that every joyous event had its counterpart. And now I accept the joy and the good times in life, and I don't worry so much about for every good there's going to be a bad. I don't think that way anymore.
Judy Blume is my guest, and she's a novelist. Her new novel is called Smart Women. It's published by Putnam. And it's a novel for adults, though I imagine teenagers could read it just fine.
Oh, I want them to. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, there isn't any reason why young readers can't read this book, particularly, I think, kids who have experienced divorce and have lived with single parents and in step families. I think that they can really identify.
When you started writing children's fiction, were your children the age of the characters in your books, and did they grow as your children did?
No, my kids were babies when I started to write, and I wrote out of the child that I was. And then as they grew older, yes, they brought back a lot of my own memories. They enabled me to see life today. And that was very important. And I worried terribly when they grew up and went off to college that there goes my career right out the door. But the letters from the kids who write to me keep me in touch.
Well, I lost my train of thought for a second. So you said that you wrote from your experiences as a kid, but I wonder how relevant they are since, in popular fiction, people like to read things that have like the right records mentioned in it and the right movies and the right language. And there's a lot of slang and invented words that young people use. Were your experiences enough to make your books relevant to younger readers when you'd started to write?
My feelings were enough, yeah. Because still, Margaret was published 12 years ago, and all of my books, from the early 70s, and the letters from the kids never stop, and they believe that they're reading about themselves. So it's not so much the right record or the right outfit. It's much more the feelings and the emotions.
You're probably the most controversial writer of fiction for young people because you write candidly about sexual relations and menstruation, masturbation, things that you wouldn't expect to find in those novels, or I guess things people have consciously left out for many years. Was it a conscious decision on your part to put it in?
No, and there's really very little of it. And I'm not sure. I think with adults, yes, sexuality tends to make them think of my books as controversial. But the kids don't at all. The kids, that's not what's important to them. Again, it's feelings and it's emotions. And it was never a conscious effort. I knew that when I was in the sixth grade, I was obsessed for a short period of time with breast development and menstruation. I wanted my period. That was a statement of growing up, becoming a woman, being normal. And I waited and I waited and I waited and I waited all the way till I was 14 and a half. But it was an important time in my life, and I remembered those feelings.
Well, you get all kinds of things down, like the way young girls will practice with tampons or pads before they get their period so that they've rehearsed and they have the feeling of experiencing.
I don't know how many kids actually do that. I did it. And I guess that other kids must do it too because they do identify so strongly with Margaret. And when I wrote Deanie, it never occurred to me that she was going to masturbate. And in fact, it's such a tiny part of the book. But when I was a kid, it would have meant so much to me to have had a book to read that let me know that other kids explored their bodies and had a special place and could get good feelings from that special place. I thought that I was the only one for a long time, and I worried about it, and I didn't talk to anybody about it.
Do you get letters from
yeah,
readers who say exactly that?
They say exactly that. I had never heard the word masturbation. And I get letters from kids who say, I also have a special place like Deanie, and I didn't know that anyone else did.
Do you think that the sexual aspects of your book have been overplayed?
Very much. Of my books for younger kids, yeah, I think very much. Never by the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Never by the children. Only by adults. And I think it's just because they really don't want to deal with those issues with their children. They don't want to know their children are reading it because then their children might be thinking about it. Then their children might have questions. And they are nervous. They don't feel well-equipped to answer those questions.
There was an article about you in the New York Times Magazine, and I guess it was 1978, by Joyce Maynard. And she quoted some parents' reactions to your books.
To Forever.
To Forever. And one of the mothers said, I really wish that my child would read pornography instead of Judy Blume's books, because at least that way she'd know what it was, and she'd read it and she'd be finished with it. or something like that. I think I.
You mean that she would, that she would know it was
she would
awful.
Know she would know it was smut. You know? she wouldn't think it was really within her reach.
I'll tell you what I remember most about that article. There was a woman who said that she worries so about her kids. Are they going to smoke dope? She's always watching them. She doesn't trust them at all, and she doesn't trust herself as a parent. And she said what she felt like doing was driving down the highway, getting out of the car, running from the car, and just burying her head in the sand or screaming at the top of her lungs. And I remembered that, and I wrote that in Smart Women because I could never understand that kind of fear. And so Bibi has a moment in this book where she's so frightened now that her child is in junior high that she wants to put her under a lamp every time she comes home from a party to look into her eyes to make sure that she's not smoking dope, that she's not drunk, that she's not doing anything. And of course, Sarah is a very reasonable, loving child who cares a lot what her mother thinks about her, and she's not about to do it.
I think, well, let me reintroduce you. Judy Blum is my guest, and her new novel is called Smart Women. I think we tend to see younger people from the perspective of what it was like when we were young, and I think all generations seem to do that.
No, I don't think so. I think that adults are afraid of the new generation. And they are more anxious to say, why don't you be like I was when I was a kid? You think you mean that they're remembering the bad things that they did or the trouble that they were in.
Well, even if they were rebellious, they define rebellion according to what it was they rebelled against and would find completely unacceptable rebelling against something different.
I think parents are much, much too afraid of their kids. Kids don't want their parents to be afraid of them. Kids want their parents to love them and accept them and respect them. And parents want the same thing. We all want the same thing. If only somehow we could talk about it.
I know one of the things that used to really offend me when I was a teenager was people who wrote books, not for, but about teenagers, you know, like pop sociology books about, you know, understanding how your teenager speaks or what are the youth revolting against today. I thought that they were just so off track and so were just kind of pompous and wrong. And I wonder how you feel being regarded as a kind of spokesperson for today's teenagers.
Well, it's not something that I chose. It's something that happened. And if now and then I can help parents be less fearful, then that's good. What I wish is that parents would read the books that their kids are reading and maybe have a clearer understanding. Maybe it would take them back into their childhoods and talk to their kids about it. You know, you can talk more easily about characters in a book than you can about each other. So you can say, well, what do you think about that Catherine did? And it's a good bridge to communication.
What are some of the issues that you think have changed between being young today and being young when you were the age of many of your characters?
The way we live, lifestyles. Divorce was almost unheard of in my life. I didn't know anyone whose parents had been divorced, so that there were no merging families and no step-siblings.
Was losing your virginity an option? You know, for
not really
respectable people?
Not really, no. I think that we knew. You know, it's funny because kids today, they don't know that there's anything that comes between a kiss and intercourse. They don't know that, and they've got to somehow figure it out or be told, hey, you know, it's fine to have sexual feelings, and it's fine to spend time with your boyfriend or your girlfriend, but you don't have to have intercourse. You can say no. We knew that, and maybe we had an easier time because we knew the rules. I would not want to go back to the 50s, though. I think what we have to do is try to help our kids make intelligent decisions, and we have to talk about sex with them much, 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 much earlier, so that they know that they have choices. They can say, no, I'm not ready, I can't handle this.
How did you handle those sexual issues with your own children?
I'm not sure that I did a great job. My son thinks I did a great job. My daughter, my son is a very open person, and so he had many, many, many questions. He would ask them. We would get books. If I wasn't sure of the answer, we would look together. And he's a very loving and sensual person. And my daughter is very shy and quiet. It was much harder for her to talk about it. I was newly single and then newly remarried when she was 14. And I think all of that was very hard for her. She's also a very loving person. But I think sexuality is a harder issue for her to deal with.
Was it easier for you, do you think, to talk about these issues with your children since you had the experience of thinking about it for your characters?
I was not able to talk to my parents about sexuality, really, although I had the warmest and most open father of any of my friends, and my friends all thought I was terribly lucky because I could talk to him about anything. But we never really talked a lot about sex, and I didn't feel comfortable asking my mother anything about it. And I vowed when I had kids, this was long before I started to write, that this was something that we would do. From the first question, there would be honest answers. And I answered them simply and to the point, and we used books.
I think, you know, after a divorce, it's easy to be bitter. And did you try to prevent any kind of negative feelings you might have felt about marriage or relationships from entering into the way you discuss it with your daughter who was entering into the world of relationships?
You know, you can try, but again, kids see things clearly. And I was a very unhappy woman for a while, and it took several years before my former husband, the father of my kids, and I got it together and began to treat each other with respect and as human beings again. And that was hard for my kids, although we never, ever fought about who can see the kids when.
Are your kids known as Judy Blume's kids wherever they go?
I don't think so. Not very much. In fact, now that they're older, I think that they get kind of a kick out of it. The character of Fudge in my younger children's books was based on Larry when he was little, and here he is, this great big 6-footer. And little kids just love it. They'll come up to him and say, "Really? Really? You're Fudge?" And Larry is now able to say, "Yeah, I was really Fudge." I don't think it ever affected them too much. But they would be able to give you a better answer.
Right. My guest is Judy Blume, and she's a novelist. She's written many novels for young people. Her new novel, Smart Women, is aimed at an adult audience, though, which isn't to say that teenagers wouldn't be interested in it. She's also the author of the bestseller, Wifey. I know that you feel that the kind of sexual aspects of your books for young people have been overplayed, but, you know, nevertheless, a lot of libraries have tried to ban the books, and some parents want to make sure that their kids don't bring it home. Well, have you been in the position where you've had to directly confront the censorship issue while you were writing a book, and your editor said, "Look, if you leave in these 2 pages, these 50 libraries are not going to carry it, and these 40 bookstores won't carry it, and it's going to reach more people and sell better if you leave it out." Self-censorship, have you had to deal with that?
I think self-censorship is a real issue today, and in the beginning when I started to write, it never occurred to me, and it never, if it occurred to my editor, he never said anything about it. And I wish I could tell you that I have never self-censored. But when I wrote the book Tiger Eyes, I don't remember, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it was at a time when there was a great deal of book banning going on. And I had one line in that book, and I wish very much that I hadn't taken it out. It was psychologically sound. It was right for the character. She explored her own body. She masturbated for the first time since the shocking, tragic death of her father. The first time that she began to feel things for other people again. And my editor said to me, "Judy, we want this book to reach as many readers as we can, and I would feel better if you would take that line out." And I wish that I hadn't, but I did. And I hope that I never do that again.
Have you confronted any of the communities that want to keep your books out of libraries? Have you been in a debate situation or anything like that?
I find debate situations really difficult. For a while, I did. I did the Donahue Show a couple of years ago with a woman from a concerned citizens group. And what I've learned is that you can't really debate because the people who want to ban books and who, because of their religious beliefs, find my work and other authors' work sinful. How can you debate that? That's what they believe. All you can do is say you're entitled to your beliefs, but you really aren't entitled to say what my kids can read and what everybody else's kids can read. So it's a tough situation, but I will defend, as long as I'm able, the child's right to read and the adult's right to read.
I think I read you quoted somewhere as saying that masturbation was actually more controversial than intercourse.
It is. Not just in my novel. A couple of months ago, I talked to a group of teenage girls, and the subject was sexuality. And it wasn't a very fruitful discussion. It was in the offices of a magazine. It was to be a story. And they were terribly open. Several of them were very experienced sexually. They had had many lovers. They were 16. And when I raised the subject of masturbation, all of the heads went down. No one would look at me. No one would talk about it. So even with kids, not just with the censors is masturbation terribly controversial or taboo, but it seems that we don't want to talk about it either.
I guess it's Judy Blume, if you're just joining us, and her new book is called Smart Women. It's a novel. Do you think that your readers are introduced to these things through your books, or you think they already know for the most part?
I think they already know. I think it just comforts them to know that they're not alone, satisfies some of their curiosity, and I think raises a lot of questions. And then the healthiest thing is if they go to their parents with the questions and their parents answer them instead of taking the book away from them and telling them that they're reading a dirty book, which is the worst possible message you can send to your child.
Well, parents tend to want to protect their children from certain ideas that they think might upset them in ways that they don't understand.
I don't buy that. I don't think it's a question of protection. I think it's they're protecting themselves because it's too hard for them to confront these issues. They want to think, they want to pretend that children don't need to think about these things, but you can't control what's in your child's mind.
I know a couple with young children who are like 7 and 5, and you know all those Stories for Free Children type books, like from Ms. Magazine, yeah, where all the children have had a divorce, divorced parents, and they really don't want their children to read any books like that because in their community there aren't many divorces, and they're really afraid it would make their children nervous that their parents would have a divorce soon, which they don't intend on doing.
I do get letters from children whose parents seem happily married, and the kids do worry. This is happening all around me. Suppose it happens to my parents. They had a fight last night. Suppose this is it. Suppose it's divorce. And surely with children 7 and 5, you don't have to choose those books to share with your children. There are plenty of other books to share. But eventually, those children are going to meet children whose parents have been divorced. And the subject will come up, and I hope then they'll talk about it in a way that makes their children less afraid or makes their children able to be good friends.
You've had a lot of successes in the publishing field of what's called now young adults, but you've also had a bestseller for adults, Wifey, and now you have a new adult book, Smart Women. Are there any striking differences between the publishing world of young people and of adults, either in terms of the advances or the way your book gets reviewed or the kind of publicity it's given?
There's much more publicity given to an adult book if the publisher chooses to. For years and years and years, I just sat home and wrote, and I got $1,000 as an advance for each book. And it never occurred to me that it would change. I was very happy. And I think that the field of young adult literature has become so popular. And what's changed now is that people are truly buying children's books in bookstores. It used to be that children's books sold almost exclusively to libraries. And if 5,000 copies sold, that was wonderful. And now with kids able to buy their own paperbacks and choose their own books, bookstores finally becoming aware of the fact that there's a market here, that kids do indeed love to read. But I haven't answered your question. The differences. Ask me again. Ask me a specific one.
Oh, that's okay. I mean, if there aren't any differences that have really struck you.
You know, the hype. There's a big difference in the hype.
You don't go on book tours, I guess, for books for younger people.
Well, I've been on a couple, but I think that was only after I became some kind of media figure myself. But
one of the differences is that with younger people, you have recognition from people who aren't your peers. And when you write a bestseller for adults, it's your peers who are buying the book and reading it know about you. Is there a difference there for you? Do you prefer it when it's your peers?
No. I love my readers, and I don't care how old they are. And I love the intimate relationship that I have with them, with all of the letters that they write to me.
What did you read when you were young?
I grew up on Nancy Drew and Maud Hart Lovelace. Do you know her?
No, I know the Nancy Drew stuff.
Her books are still around, and they were wonderful books. There were only about 5 or 6 of them. But by the time I was in 6th grade, I was going through my parents' bookshelves. I mean, there were no kids' books that interest me. There were no families like my families. There were no kids like me. Everything was so perfect, and I knew that couldn't be real life because I was living real life, and so were my friends. So I do think when I started to write, I wanted to write the kinds of books that I wish I had had to read. But I discovered in my parents' bookshelves Salinger and Ayn Rand, and there were no restrictions. I didn't read all of them right away.
Are there children's authors that you consider to be classic and timeless?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, someone like E.B. White is classic and timeless. Beverly Cleary may be classic and timeless. I hope so. It will be interesting to see. I'm now through, coming through a second generation kind of kids. Not that they're parents, but, you know, a second generation of 10 to 13-year-olds. And I have readers who I will meet who are in their early 20s who say, hey, you know, I grew up reading your books and it's hard for me to believe. And they are now my adult readers.
Do you think that your books hold up for the young people now? Again, because you put in a lot of very contemporary detail into it, and
I know that they do now. Mm-hmm. I cannot tell you in 10 or 20 years, and I'm not sure that it makes any difference at all. If it matters to the kids who are reading them now, that's all. It's not my goal to be timeless and classic.
Did your children read your own books when they were young?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Did they like them?
Yes. Randy was always a reader, and so she read everything from... She used to come home from school and pull the pages out of the typewriter and read them. She was a very, very interested young reader. Larry never liked the loose pages. He always said, I want to read it when it's a book. The loose pages fall down. And they still, of course, they read with great interest what I write.
Did they give you feedback on the accuracy of your characterizations or the language that you use?
Very little. Very little. Occasionally, Randy would say, we don't say it that way. And she would tell me how we do say it.
Judy Blume is my guest, and her new novel is called Smart Women, and it's just been published by Putnam. So now that your children are in college or maybe even graduated from college...
One has graduated.
Are you going to be able to continue writing and being in touch with what younger people are doing?
I hope so. I find that it's very dangerous for me as a writer to think about it all. When I start thinking about it, I'm convinced that I'll never have another idea. I've never suffered writer's block, but I don't worry about that. I worry about idea block. There won't be another idea, therefore there'll never be another book. Or it's such an emotional way of living, writing, that I will never do this again. But both my son and my mother cried over this new book and made me cry. And that is something, I'm going to cry now, that's very special to me. My son read this book. It's the first time that he's read one of my books as an adult reader. And he said, I cried, Mom. I never thought about what it was like for parents who are divorcing. It never occurred to me that they spent 1 minute thinking maybe they shouldn't have, or maybe they could get back together again. He said, up to now, I've only thought about divorce from a kid's point of view and what it's like for the kid. And my mother, who's very shy and quiet, said to me, I learned so much about you from this book. She said, about the way you think and about the way you feel. And I feel close to you.
What was the inspiration behind the book? When did you know that?
I knew I wanted to write this book when I was going through a lot of trouble with my own teenagers. And I said, hey, wait a second. There's another side here. I've always taken the child side. And suddenly I was a woman, and I was dealing with kids who were giving me trouble. And I said, I've got to write about it from this side. But by the time I got around to doing that, my children were no longer giving me trouble. They had passed out of that phase. And so I was able to also take the child's side and look at this love story from everybody's point of view.
Is one of your hopes that families will pass it around from generation, that the parents
yes.
will read it and the kids
yes.
will read it?
And talk about it. Or it isn't even necessary to talk about it all the time. Just to share a book, it's a shared experience. If you can't talk about it, fine. But you've been through it together.
Do you have another book in the works now?
Well, of course, I always say this is the last book, but I do have something swimming around up there. I want to write about stepfamilies again for younger readers.
Do you always say this is the last book?
Always. Always, yes.
Are you anxious to stop writing?
Sometimes I think I am, but then I know that it can't be. I mean, those who are close to me say when I start to get fidgety after a while, they will say, why don't you start another book? It's time for you to start another book. And I know myself, something goes off, there's a bell, it says it's time. I want to get involved again.
What do you do between books?
Well, I have a heavy-duty business life.
You do?
Well, I have all of... by business, I mean the business of writing. I have all these 2,000 letters a month mm-hmm. that I try to deal with. And I have a little foundation called the Kids Fund. And we give grants to groups that try to bring parents and kids together. And that's time-consuming but wonderful. And I don't know how long we'll be able to keep it going. And I've learned to play again. I've learned that you don't have to write all the time. I'm not a compulsive writer.
Well, good luck with your new books. I'm sure there'll be some. I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Here.
It was fun. I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it, too. Judy Blume has been my guest, and she's written many books for young readers.